Welcome to TA1, everything you wanted to know about adventure racing and then some. I'm your host, legendary Randy Erickson, and I know some of you will be bummed, but this is not an Eco Challenge adventure. This is probably a little bit more important. It's with Troy, who probably, I don't know, Eco Challenge bookends his stint at keeping adventure racing live in the U.S. So probably fairly important that you listen to this and enjoy it and have a good time. So just do it. You know, I think we actually probably mentioned Eco Challenge anyway, so you can get your fix. Or I suppose I should say, go ahead and rate and review on iTunes. I think we're on Spotify and Google Play also, all those places. And I will have a link to the donate button. I had a couple of nice surprises in my mailbox in the last few weeks. I appreciate people helping out a little bit with it. And thank you, those of you that donated a little bit. And so this will be Wednesday night. All of you that are participating in the VNATS this weekend, don't forget to film yourself. And remember, phones go sideways when you take a video. And remember, turn it sideways, then hit play. Because if you hold it vertically and hit play and turn it sideways, it doesn't work very well. So do that. Post it to the VNATS event page or USARA or your Facebook page or wherever. Tag we are together. Tag me so I can find it, and we'll get this all put together. And I know we'll have a backbone for the film because Paulette and our friend Eric Concannon are doing my little 12-hour adventure I put together for them. So we'll be making them film, and I will be doing some filming and taking some pictures. So almost like a real race. Then if you're interested, I think there's a couple of solo spots left for the Bear in northern Georgia in 2 weeks, the 25th, 26th. So might be a little bit late to get signed up and go there, but come on down and say howdy. All right, let's see what Troy has to say. So that's where I say thanks for listening. Go fast, take chances. Hope you have a good nationals, and Eco will be back next week. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hello.
Troy, this is Randy.
Hey, man, I'm trying to get my Skype hooked up right now.
Oh, okay. Well, or you can talk on the phone, whatever works for you.
Well, phone's fine with me if that's okay with you.
Yep, just...
Let's just do that.
Yeah, that's fine. That works good. I just had to do my Skype thing. I always forget to turn off the audio input, so I hear myself twice.
Were you at Eco actually?
No, they only take good people.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know if I'd rate you like that, but I'm surprised. Really, they didn't have you there. I guess they're such a TV thing now.
Yeah,
maybe always have been.
Yeah, I mean, what I do is like daily stuff, and of course they didn't have any of that, so. Yeah, and they have all their crews and camera crews and stuff, and so.
But, well, I guess part of it too is they don't want the cat out of the bag early, so you can really go and report on it because they don't want it until they show it months later or whatever. So.
Yeah, and they actually apparently still have a little bit of an embargo on information. Yeah, because there's no. Results or anything like that out there that are, official. So, and I think from what I gather, there might be stuff coming out after Labor Day. So,
interesting.
Yeah, that gives 3 weeks for people to watch the show, and it makes sense.
Yeah, I'm happy it's back. You know, it's good. I think it's what, I don't know about you, it's definitely what drew me to the sport.
Oh yeah, definitely those old. I mean, we had them all on VHS tape till probably 4 or 5 years ago, sitting around, and it's funny.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's like, well, let's. Yeah, I don't even know if we have a VHS player. Maybe we can get rid of them.
Right. Fair enough.
So have you been looking at all this stuff going on and thinking, man, I maybe just got out of here just in time so I don't have to deal with all these people?
You know, it's exciting. You're talking about like all the new people that are wanting to come into the sport.
Yep.
I think it's super exciting. I couldn't be happier with the group that's taken over. I mean, most of those guys have been serving on our board for years and have been involved. And I think they've got the – I think I'd say the talent and the skills to really take it to the next level, and so I'm super excited for them. I think I'm excited to see what happens.
So, well, let's go down this path for a little bit, and then I want to know more about you eventually.
Okay,
but why was this the time that you felt? Did you feel like you could step away, or you wanted to, or?
Yeah,
what was your mindset?
You know, that's an interesting question. So it's interesting. In my lifetime, I have completely changed careers 4 or 5 times. It kind of seems like, you know, I do something for a while and then I like a new challenge. But I've been at the helm of the USRA for like 22 years now. So it's something that I've done for a long time. I just fell in love with the sport. And, you know, I kind of got involved early as a more of a as a race director and a racer. Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, as things change, I'm an old dog. I'm not very social media savvy. I just think it's time. Like, you know, things are changing and it's time for some of the guys that are kind of the a little more skilled in that, in those arenas, and that are maybe a little younger and a little not as long in the tooth. It's time for those guys to take over.
Yeah, well, don't talk like that, because I keep thinking that way too, and then I'm like, yeah, but I see all these, like, the stray dogs, and it's like, yeah, I think we have a few more good years in us.
We do. I mean, it's not that I'm going to completely, you know, I'm excited. I have a 13-year-old daughter, and we're running together this summer a bunch. I'm trying to keep up with her, basically. And she's like, hey, Papa, let's do an adventure race together. And that's super exciting to me. I've also got an 11-year-old son. And so I've been looking forward to the day where we could all do a race, even a short race together, just for fun. And so, you know, I'm kind of looking at it. Okay, now I get to go back and do it from the fun side, where I'm not actually running an event or overseeing it, but just getting to go out and run around in the woods with the family. It'll be awesome.
Yeah, I hear you there. That being on the other side with fewer responsibilities is pretty nice.
Yeah, yeah. And I still plan, you know, like I'm planning on volunteering for Nationals next year and still plan to be involved here and there. I may start putting on some adventure races again. It's been a long time since I've actually had a promotions company that put on events. So, you know, we may look back into doing some of that at some point. But, yeah, we're just going to see where it goes.
Yeah. So 22 years ago when you started USARA, I mean, how did you do it? There was no internet.
Yeah, it was, you know, so really the driving force behind it, my very first adventure race, there wasn't that many guys in the U.S. putting on races. And, I think I paid about $5,000 for insurance for the very first race I put on. And so I was like, man, I put that one on and I'd race in a couple of races. And I was just like, you know, we need to get some safety standards in place or someone's going to get seriously hurt. And if we band together, we're going to have some buying power. And so hopefully we can get the price down, you know, for events, because it won't cost us a fortune for insurance. So I started calling guys like Dan Barger, Don Mann, I'm trying to think of Liz Caldwell and Barry Siff, you know, some of the early guys in the sport. And we started talking. It's really funny because Don Mann used to tell a story. He's like, I thought you were an insurance salesman when you first called me. And so anyway, those guys were our early board also. You know, they're the ones that really helped us. And I laugh, like our first set of safety standards was like, you know, 10 bullet points or something. And then it grew as the sport grew. But those guys, you know, Tracen Thayer was another name that was involved early as a board member. They were all people who really helped us as, you know, at the start, to develop things like that. And so it was, we were all trying to figure it out together.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's some interesting names from back in that day.
Yeah.
There's a dog barking somewhere. She's getting her supper.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Hey, where do you live anyway?
I'm in Black Hills of South Dakota.
Okay.
So my start was PQ Badlands.
Okay.
So I was with Don. Right
on.
That was
when Don had taken over PQ.
Yeah, and they had a, you know, a deal with BBC to film the race. And then, like, 6 weeks before, you know, they're like, no, we don't have any money. We're not coming. So, and I'd been doing some little things with my wife was on a local team. So he's like, you want to film it? I'm like, yeah, sure. I'm one person. I can film a 10-day race.
Right. That's awesome, though. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the thing is, it's literally in our backyard. Like, I mean, literally there was a checkpoint 400 meters from our house.
So, how about that?
So, yeah, I knew the secret. And I had been part of the organization, so I knew all the back roads, and I knew where they're going, and I knew how they had to get there. So, I mean, you know, I look back on that video, and it's, you know, it's exactly what I said it would be. Everybody was going to be in it.
Right.
You know, so.
That's,
you know,
cool, man.
It was. So, yeah, that was my background, but. So, I mean, when you start USARA, how long did it take before you thought it was going to be successful or was successful in your mind?
Well, you know, I think right away, pretty quickly, we were able to have some buying power for insurance, and then we were able to start, you know, to put some safety standards down. So I think, you know, really quickly we felt that was success. That was something that would help the sport, you know, continue in a safe manner. And so early on, I mean, it's not that we weren't really kind of looking at how many races we were, you know, sanctioning or whatever. We were sanctioning most, that were out there. And so, it took a long time. I mean, I had a full-time business as a promotions company that put on events and mostly adventure races. We did some mountain bike races later. But mostly adventure races. And so that was really my full-time job in USARA. We were just, you know, running to try to help grow the sport. And so, I guess that's the long answer there.
Hey, people that listen to podcasts like long answers.
Oh yeah, fair enough. So, well, and then we, you know, so, again, it wasn't just me. It was, we had a great, we've always had great boards, you know, and really we've always tried to build the board with guys who are both race promoters and racers. So they really understood kind of both sides, of the sport. Because if not, you can kind of get imbalanced one way or the other. Racers don't really understand everything a race director has to do. And if you're just a race director, you might not really understand everything from a racer standpoint. So, you know, we were really blessed to have great guys always, guys that I think were really the pioneers of the sport in the U.S. On the board, and they just had so much experience. And so that was just a real, I would say, honor to work with those guys.
Yeah, well, you've kept it going for 20 years. That's pretty amazing. But so was the growth pretty linear? Was the growth keep going, or were there peaks and troughs?
You know, peaks and drops at one point, you know, probably are in the, what I'd call the heyday was when, you know, both the high-tech 24-hour series, the high-tech sprint series was going. Urban races got real popular, like the Wild Onion in Chicago. And we actually partnered with those guys. I put on a Wild Onion in Houston. We had, for 3 or 4 years, we did a 24-hour race in Houston that, like, started on the field at Minute Maid before an Astros game. We did the national anthem with them and ran out of the stadium. And so it was, you know, I would say those were probably kind of the very peak. And it's interesting because I didn't even really, know this or think of it as, like, when people were like, well, how come we didn't just keep going up and going up? And it was actually at a conversation with our risk managers one time, and the guy that was the president of the company said, you know, all sports hit a peak. Like, all sports take off, they go up, and they hit a peak, and then they start coming down, and they kind of find their spot and level out. Some come way down, some don't come down as far. And so I feel like kind of after those years, we kind of found our spot and chugged along. You know, the one thing that I think it's interesting, we went through lots of, you know, just growing pains and learning things and things that were kind of funny at times. Like, I can remember early on having these huge debates with some of the pioneers of the sport when they were saying, a 24-hour race is not an adventure race. That's ridiculous. Like, and really mad, and I was fighting for them. Like, look, if we don't have shorter events, we're not going to really bring a lot of people in the sport. Most people aren't going to go do a 4-day race for their first event or an 8-day race for their first event. You know, it's just not. It's in. So I try to equate it to running. I was like, you know, those people don't sign up for an ultra marathon for their very first run. They do a 5K and then a 10K and then eventually build up maybe to a half marathon. And so it was just kind of funny when I looking back that there, you know, it wasn't even an 8-hour. They're like, a 24-hour shouldn't be called an adventure race. And so those were just things, you know, that we had to work through. And I think, you know, at times we found a really great balance of short enough races for beginners. And a lot of times the you know, more experienced guys are going to come to those too if that's the only thing going on. And then the longer races really to, I think, you know, with the appetite of experienced guys and guys that want to do expedition races and things like that.
Yeah, brings them into the sport.
Is there something that you've seen over the years that every successful race does right?
You know, well, that's a great question. It kind of, there's a lot of different ways to look at that. So, you know, what is a successful race? You know, I think if we look at it from what's successful from the racer standpoint, let's say you go do a race, I think, you know, guys that are successful race directors are willing to somewhat be coached by people who have more experience than them, and where they're, you know, where we really see guys that put on successful races is either they have the skill to, or they find someone who has the skill to make sure their checkpoints are dialed, like they're in the right place. The UTMs match up with where they are and on the map and all of that. I think that, you know, that's always the downfall is when you get a checkpoint in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. It can really, you know, ruin a race.
Yeah.
But I think there's other things successful too. You know, is it a race director that's bringing new people into the sport? Then there's a whole nother formula for that. And I think in a way that's something that the early guys were all doing, and we don't see that as much anymore. So the guys that were pioneers, there were no adventure racers. So if you wanted to put on a race, you know, the first question you had to ask was, well, how am I going to get people to actually sign up for this race? Because there's not really any adventure racers. And so what guys were doing, you know, was putting on clinics, teaching, I mean, really looking at, you know, people know how to trail run, but the, you know, mountain biking or paddling sometimes is a skill that's tough, and then obviously orienteering and navigating are the real skills that a lot of people lack. And so a lot of the early guys were putting on lots of free orienteering clinics and just adventure race 101 clinics to help kind of build their clientele and build the pool of adventure racers in the U.S. And that really helped. And then later we saw a big growth of clubs that, you know, really filled that gap. We saw some huge clubs at times around the country, from, you know, like Houston Adventure Racing Club to NYRA, which is still around, New York Adventure Racing Association. So different clubs. There's some out of Atlanta too that were like trailblazers, and you know those were really helping bring up young racers and new racers and pairing them with experienced racers so that people were comfortable trying their first race and just all kinds of things like that were exciting to see and you know really kind of what the spirit of adventure racing is all about.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, because you don't hear a lot of clubs that are around anymore. Although I'm seeing people say, "Well, yeah, we have a club," you know, with you know in the last week, but I don't think they've done anything for 10 years. But so, yeah.
Yeah, they definitely died out. I'd love to see. I mean, I tell guys that all the time. I'm, you know, one of the things that we've done for years, you know, really since the start behind the scenes, is when someone calls up and says, "I want to put on an adventure race." We try to help them not have a Chinese fire drill for their first event, not to make the same mistakes that guys early on were making just because they don't know any better. And so, you know, we really try to help look at their course and coach them through possible changes that would make their event better. But that was one of the things we really would try to coach too was, you know, man, think about doing free clinics at your REI or your local outfitter and all these other things that are going to help, you know, build racers, and if you want to do a long race, think about also doing a short race. So there's a beginner friendly event where they can come out and do it, and kind of get interested in the sport, and just things like that.
Yeah, just
guess what? 20 years ago, we're having the same conversations now, right?
That's it. It is. It's we're still what I would call not a mainstream sport, and it's you know. Orienteering and mountain biking and paddling are the three reasons probably why. Like those are not mainstream sports, and so you know you've got to get people comfortable with those disciplines if you want to get them to come out and have a go.
Yeah, I always say we're in the corner of the niche of sports.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it for sure.
What would you think the upper end of adventure racing is? You know, people always say Olympics, and I think that's not a happening thing, but what do you think where it could go?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I mean, eco definitely is the somewhat the holy grail. I mean, the World Series is you know, could be considered there, some of those races for sure, and some of the old races, the Raid Galois, Mile 7, that were really foundational, I think, in helping the sport grow worldwide. I mean, Eco with the TV coverage they had before and that they're back again is great. And, I we hope to see that. I mean, when you talk to guys that are our age or my age that have been in the sport for a long time, almost 100% of them came to the sport because they saw the Eco Challenge on TV. And got excited about adventure racing. So, you know, it would be fantastic if we could see that happen again for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if we're getting the same basic interest that we got 20 years ago with Eco, but I wonder if it is going to be more sustainable with the internet, with social media, with, you know, let's face it, people like to say, "Hey, look what I did." I wonder if we can keep it going.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. And, you know, things are getting more radical and more radical every day. I can remember back when I hardly knew anyone who had done a marathon. And then now I hardly know anyone whose grandmother hadn't done a marathon now, you know. Yeah. So, I mean, I think you bring up a great point that could easily happen because people definitely want to be challenged and want to, you know, go out there. I mean, it's amazing to me when you see some of the teams that sign up for the Eco Challenge that really don't have the experience to sign up for something like that. And you think, wow, those guys are super brave, man. you know? And so, it's and then also to see some of them actually do really well. It's inspiring and awesome and really what the sport is all about. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that could definitely happen. It's you know, I think the thing we're fighting probably is the original Eco Challenge was probably one of the first reality TV shows, and so back then, people who really had no interest in doing an adventure race still thought it was really interesting TV and would watch it.
Yeah.
And now with all the, you know, reality stuff, and I think people like the conflict, the backstabbing, and all different things that go on there, maybe the Eco Challenge isn't as interesting to someone who's not a real outdoor person. But I don't know, because they did a great job of telling the story, I think, when you watched it this year. And so that could be, you know, they're doing a good job of making it not just watching a guy mountain bike for 8 hours straight. And so I certainly hope that that combined with social media does bring a big resurgence to the sport.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what I'm seeing is the biggest complaint is I didn't get to see my team, you know, which, you know, there's 66 teams. It's not going to happen, but yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, hopefully we can keep that, you know, the positive stories instead of, yeah, the backstabbing ones. So,
yeah, well, like I'm saying, like, not in adventure racing, but in other,
yeah, but that's
in other,
yeah, what people want
TV,
see.
That's what people want to see, right? And yeah. So I agree with you. So, yeah, and, you know, and that brings up an interesting thought or idea in this. You know, I probably lean a little more towards the old school of thought in that, you know, I think a lot of people want to be able to watch any adventure race and have almost live coverage of what is going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
A lot of times for the race directors, that part, providing, you know, what they can is much harder than the whole rest of producing the race. And because obviously you're out in the middle of nowhere, so you don't have great coverage, and you can't really always tell the story, you know, exactly while it's happening. And I don't know. I think sometimes it's okay for the story to be told when they get home. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to happen. But I do also understand it's exciting for people to watch from all over the world while something's going on. So I think it's maybe trying to find the right balance, but also the watchers have to realize that sometimes when it goes dead for a while, it may just be because they just don't have any kind of reception where they're at, and so they can't, you know, without $1 million budget, they can't tell the story exactly as while it's happening.
So. Yeah, I know that how that goes, but I mean, there is a huge, you know, the dot watchers are huge in major races, and between them, you know, and what, you know, photos and videos we get out, and, you know, it's getting to the point now that you can almost do live coverage anywhere. You know, you got a cell signal on a GoPro, you can do a live shot now. But yeah, so I think those people that really want to know have a huge network, and they love trying to figure out what's going on. So, you know, and there's just little things I think that race directors need to do, like make sure maps are available online as soon as the racers get them, because, you know, adventure racers love maps.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it is definitely fun. I can remember some of the very last Ecos watching, you know, friends that were racing and trying to, especially when they get lost and you're like screaming at the computer screen.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no, turn around. No, what are you doing?
Yep.
You know, and so, yeah, it's fun. It can be fun for sure.
Yeah. What's the... And maybe you won't be able to tell me because you don't have to name names, but what's the most ridiculous phone call you ever got to USARA about, you know, somebody wants to do something?
Well, we've had a couple of things. So I had a guy one time call me to complain that he did a race and the guy didn't remove all the spiders from the course before the race. And I really didn't, you know, that was a hard one to even respond to. You're just like, okay. So, you know, that one definitely was out there for sure. We've had some, you know, and I don't know if I'd call them ridiculous, but we've had some definitely ones that want to, for instance, have shooting, let's say, in an event. And, you know, it's interesting, a good friend of mine who, I remember when I got the very first phone call for someone that wanted to do that, and I said, well, let me call our risk managers, but I made a call to a buddy of mine first who I raced with a lot, who had shot on the U.S. Army biathlon team. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, you know, guy's asking about this. What do you think? And he said, let me tell you something. A military biathlon is the most regulated thing you will ever go to. He said, it's not like a civilian one because they can actually kick you in the rear end if you're doing something wrong, yeah. You know. And he's like, when I was on the U.S. team, someone got shot at one of those events. And he's like, and I'm telling you, like, if you can get shot at one of those events, you know, I would have thought that could never happen at one of those events. And so, you know, that pretty much answered it for me. And my risk managers echoed it. So we've had, you know, and I like it. I mean, part of adventure racing is people getting creative. And, you know, we saw scooters and inline skating on urban races before and, you know, making boats and just all kinds of, I love the creativity. And so, I'd be cautious to really, I wouldn't, you know, maybe have answered this wrong. I don't know if I would say that's dumb, but it was a little scary, maybe would be more the right thing, because we love it when guys are thinking outside the box and wanting to, you know, give something new to the racers.
So you're not too concerned about the axe throws at Cowboy Tough one year.
and you know what? I don't even know if I knew about that in advance. they probably didn't tell us they were doing that. So,
it was safe. Trust me, I was there.
yeah, fair enough. So, yeah, again, it's great. I think it's really great when race directors, you know, especially if they can tie it to something in the region. Mm-hmm. So they're in a region and they, you know, whatever is popular there, they try to kind of tie that in or make it a part of the race. That's fantastic, because that's part of adventure racing too, is getting to go somewhere that you haven't been before and experience that area and, you know, the people that live in that area and all of that.
Yeah. Well, and that's what they did at Cowboy Tough. They had it at Fremont, Norfolk, and, you know, they had some reenactors there explaining what they were doing and showing them. And, yeah, you know, it broke up a like really long bike ride. So yeah, the racers love that kind of stuff, a little bit different. And,
for sure.
So, and,
And it's just great. It's yeah. Again, things like that are what guys will, you know, are part of pieces of the race that people will really remember.
Yeah. So let's talk about you. How did my favorite question? How did you get involved in this idiocracy?
Well, yeah, good question. You know, I was kind of your typical dirt bag. I mean, I was a trail running and rock climbing and paddling and kayaking, and we saw the Eco Challenge on TV and we're just, you know, immediately we're just mesmerized. We're like, man, I got to do that. And then at the time, I couldn't afford it. I mean, I think the entry fee back then was like $14,000 or something. Yeah. And, you know, for a team, and couldn't afford it, and couldn't afford to take the time off from work to go do it. And so I was like, man, I want to put on a race like that, that just everyday dirtbags like me can do. You know? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of told my friends about what I wanted to do, and they're all like, you're crazy, man. No one's going to pay to go, you know, get brutalized in the woods for 24 hours after bike and run and paddle. And I'm like, you know, they're like, it's not going to happen. You shouldn't even waste your time trying to lay out a course. And I'm not really the guy to tell that you can't do something to. That motivates me a lot. And so I said, well, I'm going to have a go at it. And I was shooting for my very first race. I was shooting to get 20 teams, and we ended up with 45 teams.
Yeah.
And it's a 24-hour race, and learned a lot. You know, if I would have put the same race on 3 years later, I would have been really disappointed. Yeah, you know, and so, but the racers were, you know, we didn't have any major disasters, and the racers were patient as we figured it out. And we started putting on more and more events, and it just kind of went from there. And, you know, I look back now, and it was just such a blessing to get to the people I got to know, to see people do amazing things and teams do amazing things, and just to see the camaraderie. I'm just so thankful for all of that.
Yeah. So after you start doing that, then, but do you get a chance to do much racing, or did you get stuck putting them on?
You know, it was a little bit of both. I didn't race as much as I wanted to, yeah. But I did get to race quite a bit. There was a period, you know, I was still single, and so I had plenty of time to train, and there was a period where I raced fairly competitively. And at that time, you know, the 24-hour nationals I could never race at, but we also, back then we had a sprint nationals that was like an 8 or 9 hour race. And for a few years in a row, we put it on in Florida, and so we had good race directors, so I was able to go with my team and race at those events, which was a lot of fun, besides lots of local events as well. So I got to do a good amount of racing. And even did a race with my wife when she was about, or actually the only race that me and her have ever done together. She was about 6 months pregnant with my daughter, and we ended up winning the race. And so we always laugh and tell our daughter that she has a win in uterus under her belt. And so that was kind of a funny little note in history for us.
A legacy adventure racer.
Yeah, exactly.
So was there, what's the one when you were racing that you really wanted to do?
The Eco was definitely on the list. Yeah. And it never happened. And you know, it could happen now, I guess, but it's probably that ship has probably sailed for me. Yeah, if I could go back in time, I would have, at one period, I would have made time to go do that for sure.
Yeah, that's the one. You know, nowadays everybody has to say God's Own. I suppose they'll start saying Eco Challenge now, but.
Yeah.
So, who's, this is a little strange question because there's not a lot of history out there about racers, but. Like, who's the best racer you know that nobody knows?
Oh, good question. Who's the best adventure racer I know that nobody knows? Wow. It's kind of funny, and I guess it kind of depends on who we're asking, right, when we say nobody. Because I think if you ask a lot of the guys that are racing right now, names that would be real common to us, they wouldn't maybe know, like Robin Benincasa or Rebecca Rush or Patrick Harper and you know, guys like that. And those guys were all amazing, you know, racers. And Ian Adamson, I mean, you can go on and on. Yeah. There's a ton of them. Oh, man, you really caught me off guard with this one. I'm going to have to think about it a little.
Okay.
And come back.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can tell you I'd love to tell you a couple of quick little stories about some of those early guys that raced, you know, Eco a lot and other big races.
Yep.
I mean, like, you know, I can,
dish us
Rebecca. Yeah. So Robin. I mean, Rebecca's awesome. And, you know, Rebecca's a funny story. A lot of people probably don't know this. Here's some dirt on Rebecca. Good dirt. Rebecca comes from a climbing background. She was a climber when she got invited by someone to do the Eco Challenge, actually, you know, and to be on their team. And if you ask her back in those days, once she became an adventure racer, the one sport that she really liked the least was mountain biking, which is really funny because she became such a great mountain biker, you know, before she liked the paddling and the climbing better. She became such a great mountain biker that after her adventure racing career, she holds, I think, like 7 or 8 world championships for like solo 24-hour championships, and she made a whole second career out of mountain biking, and that was the discipline she liked to lead when she was racing, which is pretty interesting. But it also speaks a lot to her determination and, you know, how great an athlete she is.
Yeah.
Robin used to, for years, when Robin would come to our national championships, Zanfell, who was a great sponsor, would always fly her out. And the president of Zanfell would come too, a guy named Steve Sisler, who's an awesome guy and a great fan of the sport. And so they would bring Robin out, and what she would do, it was so great. Every year, she would, you know, in our 24-hour, it was 30-hour, I guess, national championship, she would just go out on the course, and then in middle to the back of the pack team, she would just jump in with the team and travel with them for 20 minutes. You know, she'd run with them if they're running or whatever, and then she'd say good luck, and then she'd find another team and jump with them and run with them for a while, and then another one, and then another one. And, man, so many people were just blown away by that, and were, yeah. And it was so such a special moment for them to have someone who was such a great racer and a famous racer to do that. You know, they just say, man, that was just such an awesome time when she did that. And I'll tell you something about, so for a while, Patrick Harper was our course checker for nationals. So, you know, he'd come out, we'd fly him out the week before the race, and he'd go out and make sure all of the checkpoints were in place. You know Patrick, who used to race for Team Montrail?
I've heard the name, but yeah, he's kind of not on my radar.
Yeah, okay, so this, I've never seen anything like this. And Patrick was back in the day, he was known as a really, really one of the top navigators. Went back in the day, and one day, and back then, we wouldn't get the maps in advance. We wouldn't get the maps until we got to the race, right? So yep. We're at a national championship somewhere. You know, I pick him up at the airport, and we drive to where the course is, and the race director is like, here's a set of maps for you guys at the course. And we get the maps, and I'm not kidding you. Patrick looks at the map for maybe 5 minutes. He's looking at these, you know, this topo map. And he's like, come on, I want to go look at a couple of things before it gets dark today. I'm like, all right. So we go, and he just throws the maps in the backseat of the car. And I'm like, and he starts the car and takes off driving. And I'm like, do you want me to navigate to, you know, whatever checkpoint we're going to? No, I got it. I'm like, you sure? And he's like, yeah, we drive for like 45 minutes. Randy, we're making all these turns. And, I mean, it's not like it's a boat ramp. We're going right down the road, right? It's this point that's out in the middle of nowhere. And, I mean, he pulls up and jumps out, and then we grab the map, and we're right there. And I'm just like, okay, how did you just do that? And he's like, I have a photographic memory. He's like, I could see the map the whole time I was driving.
Wow.
And I'm just like, wow. I mean, that was just, it blew my mind for sure. And I'm like, maybe that's part of the reason, that and a lot of work, you know, why he's such a great navigator. But that was just a really interesting point that stands out in my mind for sure.
Yeah, that'd be a handy thing to have.
for sure.
So I know you've sort of answered this, but I mean, what's going to happen now? That's a simple question. I mean, that's kind of what we already talked about, but let's distill this. What's going to happen now?
You know, what I think's going to happen now, yeah. Maybe it's like an adventure race. I don't know. We're going to have to run the race to find out what happens, man. what do I think? I think we're going to see a lot of new people coming into the sport, from both, Eco driving them in, the new guys that are running the USRA are working hard, to go pull more people in, and, you know, they're really going to be dialing up, I think, the social media to help with that. And I think we're going to see the sport go through another resurgence, and I think that's exciting. And hopefully, again, with social media and all that, it'll just continue to snowball.
Yeah. Does USARA have any kind of a metric about what the retention rate is? How many people do one race that continue on? Or is that just in, you know, the race directors just have all that stuff?
You know, yeah, they have more of it. I can tell you that doesn't happen very often. You know, most people that come out, as long as it's a good event, and, you know, really there's, I can't remember the last time there was just a really big, big problem at a race. I think most people get hooked when the first time they do it, and they do more. I still think that there's a need for kind of developing and training young racers up. It's just like everything, it has a life cycle. People get married, have kids, whatever, and move on. They're like, you know, they don't have the time to train anymore to do it. And so you constantly got to be trying to find new people and bring new people in for sure.
Yeah. I got just a couple more, and I always say that, and then I have a couple more, but
that's all right.
Do you have a favorite national?
Oof! Wow, that's a good one too. I have lots of favorite nationals.
Give me a couple.
Yeah, the very first one always comes to mind. So Dan Barger hosted that one out in California, and it was a really unusual. We had some really unusual weather, so we started off with we're down by this lake, and we start with just a little run into the paddle, and it's fairly warm, like everyone, you know. And we start, I mean, it's in the morning, so it's a little cool, but it warms up as they paddle, and it's a pretty comfortable day. And they came off of the paddle and some navigation, and they start this hike-a-bike that gained 5,000 feet in elevation. And about three-quarters of the way up, it's snowing, and they hit snow. When they topped out, and me and Dan Barger were sitting there at the top of the trail when they topped out, and they were, you know, it was 30 degrees or even colder and snowing. And so that night, a lot of teams, and they had a long bike and hike that night up on the mountain, a lot of teams got had some problems. And the story I remember, one thing that this one thing was one of my favorites, was there was a team from Florida that got into trouble. They didn't have the right clothing, and out in the middle of the night, they were all getting hypothermia. And a couple of the teams, and they were, you know, these weren't back of the pack either. These were probably upper, you know, not even mid-pack. They were kind of maybe in 20th place-ish teams. And two other teams stopped racing. They came upon these guys, and they knew the guys were having problems. They stopped racing. They built a fire. They gathered a ton of firewood so the guys would have a fire, to help for the rest of the night.
Yeah.
And they even gave them some of their clothes. And then they started racing again. And I was just like, I just love that story. I mean, that always comes to mind. That it was, that teams in the middle of the national championship stopped to take care of other racers. And you just don't see that in other sports.
No.
Really. And so, you know, that one definitely being our first and having that happen. And then just some other cool things. I mean, the second one that Don Mann hosted had this amazing rappel. It was so long we had to have special ropes made that were long enough for the rappel. So that was super cool. And you know, we had one in Maryland where they did these whitewater rafting in this whitewater raft park that was really neat at the start of the race. And so there's just lots of things, you know, like that. And then there's been cool disciplines that have happened, and then there's been some really cool things by different people. So I'll tell you a couple of kind of neat stories. When we were in New York, in Cahonks in New York, that night, the first night of the race, turned out to be the coldest night in New York for that year. At least up to that point. I don't know if they had a cold or not later, but the guys were wet and biking and freezing to death. And there was this old country diner kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and usually they closed on, you know, it was Friday night at midnight. So the early teams start rolling in there, super cold, you know, getting hot chocolate, and they had a big fire inside, a big fireplace, and gathered around the fire. And the lady ended up staying open till like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Until we told her that was the last team coming through. And that diner saved, you know, we would have had a 75% dropout rate just because everyone was so cold. And that gave them a chance to warm up. And they were drinking soup and coffee and hot chocolate. And so it was really neat for her to stay open so late. But she just got excited about the sport. And did it, and you know, that was super cool to have happen. And then this was really funny. The third national championship, I actually hosted it. My company did, and it was in Leesville, Louisiana. At the time, I was living in Houston, which was about a 3 to 4 hour drive over there. So I get a call from their Chamber of Commerce, and they're like, hey, you know, we found out about this race you guys are putting on, and we'd like to have you come present it to the Chamber to tell us more about it. And, you know, can we schedule you to do that? And I'm like, sure. And so I scheduled to do it, and I'm going to be honest, like I wasn't that excited about it because I was like, man, I'm going to drive for 4 hours over there, do something for 20 minutes, and then turn around and drive 4 hours back, you know. But I'm like, it's cool. They're excited about it. So I drive over there, and I give them the presentation. And when it's over, the first thing is the manager for Walmart walks up, and he goes, man, he's like super excited. He goes, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard of. And he goes, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I've got this concessions trailer. He's like, I'm going to pack it full of chips and candy bars, and it's, you know, it's got drinks, sodas, and coffee and hot chocolate. And, you know, I'm going to be at the starting line, and then you tell me a couple of other places. And I'm like, well, you could go to the TAs. And he's like, yeah. Okay, I'll be at those. And everything's free for racers.
Wow.
And I'm like, all right, cool, man. You know, and so sure enough, at the starting line, guys are just sticking, like, fistful of Snickers into their backpacks, you know. And he kept that thing stocked up. But the huge thing was, and it was so interesting, this lady walks up to me afterwards. She kind of hanging out in the background, and she walks up and just hands me a piece of paper with her name and phone number on it. And she said, if you run into any problems, give me a call. And she's like, thanks for the presentation, and leaves. And I'm like, okay, that was a little unusual, you know, but I'm like, oh, whatever. So I keep it. And so the week before the race, I get a phone call. We're starting off in the lake, and then we paddle across the lake. The racers had their canoes, or their bikes tied into the canoes. We paddle across the lake. We're portaging over the big earthen dam and into the river, and then they keep going. And then at one point in the river, they stop, get out, and take off on their bikes. So she says, hey, I've changed my mind, and you guys can't portage over the dam. Mm-hmm. And this is like 6 days before the race.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? No. And I'm like, you gave us permits 6 months ago and said it was okay to do it. But this is after 9/11's happened. And she's like, yeah, I'm not comfortable with you guys going over the dam. It's not going to happen. And I'm like, man, we got a major problem. And so we start scrambling, trying to figure out if there's any way we can change up the course or whatever. But we can't really save the paddle if we're going to do that. It's going to just be a token, ridiculous, you know, little paddle. And so I go to the number. If you have any problems, call the number. So I call the number. I'm like, I've got a doozy. And she goes, hang tight. I'll get back to you. Within an hour, she calls back and is like, you're all good. You're portaging over the dam again. And I'm like, okay. So who are you, like Al Capone's granddaughter or something? You know, did you make them an offer they couldn't refuse? And she says, no, my husband works for the governor. And so she goes, here's what happened is my husband called the lady, and she said, they're not going over the dam. And so then my husband told the governor, and the governor called the lady, and she said, they're not going over the dam. And the governor said, well, I'm going to let you choose, but you have two options. Either he's like, all these people are coming in. We're so excited about this race coming to our state. And he goes, so either you can decide to let them go over the dam, or I'm going to appoint somebody in your position, and they're going to let them go over the dam. So you think about it and let me know. So anyway, needless to say, that trip over to the Chamber of Commerce was the best 8 hours I've ever spent driving as a race director.
that might be the best story I've ever heard.
Yeah, it was. So those are some of the memories from national championships. But also, I would just have to say, just the memories of seeing teams work together and struggle in, you know, and get there is just been fantastic. It's so it never gets old. Like, it's so exciting, and it's so just inspiring. It's awesome, you know, and it's exciting to watch the front of the pack teams that are just screaming through the course, but it's equal as exciting to watch the teams that's their first time to ever do a long race or to be at a race of that caliber, and for them to work their way through the course and work together. And we had a team one time that was Masters guys, and it was really interesting because when they qualified, they actually qualified as a regular co-ed team. And I was talking to the captain. I said, you know, you guys don't have to qualify because you're a Masters team. And he's like, no, we didn't want to come to Nationals until we actually qualified for it. We wanted to earn our way there. And I thought that was so cool. Yeah. And then they ended up, you know, coming several years after that. And that is definitely at the top of the memories of all the Nationals for sure.
Very, very cool. So I don't want to make you laugh too hard, but so I'm not going to say enjoy your retirement.
Yeah.
Because I bet you're going to stay pretty busy.
Yeah, I sure hope so. And again, I love so many people in this sport and made such great friends that I'll be around. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, well, I really appreciate you taking the time. And, you know, now I think a lot of people know who you are, and that's really cool.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. So anyway, it's like, you know, I guess, again, I just want to say I have been blessed by the sport and by all the people I know in the sport. And, you know, if I could go back, and I certainly would not have changed having Adventure Race being such a major part of my life.
Very cool. And since it's my podcast, I get to say the last thing is that we all really appreciate you basically keeping Adventure Racing alive for 20 years. So we owe you a real, real debt of gratitude, and thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
That's cool. All right. We better hang up before we get too sappy, right?
Fair enough. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you. It's been great.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
On the day I was born, the nurses gathered round and gazed in wide wonder at the joy they found. The head nurse spoke up, said, "Leave this one alone." She could tell right away I was bad to the bone, bad to the bone, bad, 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 bad to the bone. I broke 1,000 hearts before I met you, and I'll break 1,000 more, baby, before I am through. I want to be yours, but a baby, yours and yours alone. I'm here to tell you, honey, I'm bad to the bone, bad to the bone, bad, 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 bad to the bone. A rich woman beg, make a good woman steal, make an old woman blush, and a Nottingham girl squeal. I'm here to tell you, honey, what I see I make my own. Here to tell you, baby, I'm mad to the bone, bad to the bone, bad, bad, bad to the bone. your streets. Kings and queens, step aside. Every woman I meet, brrr, they stay satisfied. I wanna be yours, but a baby, yours and yours alone. I'm here to tell you, honey. Bad to the bone, bad to the bone, bad, 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 bad,